quite stimulating to hear the different attitudes that people have about what the challenges are and what the solutions might be. What I'm going to try to do today is provide my own perspective. I'm not attempting to present anything new, but rather to present what my current views are at the moment in the simplest language, in the simplest pictures, with the hope that it'll stimulate some discussion, and maybe better than that, will stimulate some new ideas. So we're here to discuss challenges and how to meet them. The way I see it, there are two principal challenges that we face that we've been talking about. Said in the way I like to say it, the first is that inflation, as we currently understand it, makes no predictions unless we introduce some strong priors about initial conditions or about measure. And inflation, as we currently understand it, is highly unlikely, or at least of indeterminate likelihood, based on the most conservative measures, based on sort of standard statistical mechanical measures. That's the current state of affairs. Now, on the first point, I think there was a more or less general agreement. Ben Freivogel gave a very eloquent argument yesterday for why he thinks inflation is highly likely in our past. I think it was a very fair and honest discussion in which he presented a series of assumptions that had to be made in order to reach that conclusion. Now, the nature of any theory, for it to be compelling, I think it must have the property that it makes fewer assumptions than it makes predictions. And inflation has always been on the borderline in that sense, and that the number of predictions we talk about, the number of predictions we celebrate, are relatively few in number. A handful, maybe less than a handful, have been verified so far, depending on how you count. And when you add all the assumptions we need to have inflation, the scalar field, the potential, the properties it has to have, just those minimal assumptions, we're already, you know, at the borderline. When you have to add many other assumptions, and I think I counted at least six additional assumptions to reach this conclusion, I think there's a problem. I think it means that either we have to find a way to reduce the number of assumptions to reach that conclusion, or we have to increase the number of observational tests. And I'm not quite sure how to go either direction at present. Alan gave Guth gave a very nice presentation in which he extolled the virtues of inflation. But I assume that there are virtues that only apply if we solve these two problems. He proposed an interesting idea that by going to an infinite phase space, one might be able to find a solution to some of these problems. Again, I think it's a very interesting idea. I don't yet, it has to be an infinite phase space, which is not the limit of a finite phase space taken to infinity. That was the proposal, similar to what Andy talked about this morning. And I think it's a really interesting possibility. I just don't know what it's going to predict, whether it's going to solve these problems or not. It also bothers me a little bit that we have to go to an infinite phase space to describe whatever finite set of observations. But I'm willing to consider the possibility. I'll be interested to see how it develops. But the current situation is this. There are these huge uncertainties about the theory. And so my challenge especially for the younger people in the audience who are looking for bold things to do is, you know, why spend all your time thinking only about inflation? Why not be thinking more about alternatives? You can see there are plenty of people thinking about the inflationary opportunity, so why not think about the alternatives? After all, inflation is in a kind of weak state at the moment. It's weak competition, given these uncertainties. We don't really know where it's going to end up. In particular, an important straw man theory to consider is, just as Andy mentioned this morning, I was glad to see Andy mention this straw man theory, which is the original Big Bang model. Just the idea that the Big Bang could have occurred many times. We're one of those examples of such a Big Bang. And it might just be that the result of a Big Bang without any inflation at all. That's a theory which we don't particularly like, but in terms of its likelihood, let's say as measured by Penrose's entropy argument, it's actually more likely than going through a period of inflation. And furthermore, it requires fewer degrees of freedom. The only degrees of freedom required in this theory are the ones we actually observe. We don't have to invent anything, any scalar field or inflaton. So That's competition, and we should ask ourselves the question when we're thinking about inflation or alternatives to inflation, how well we compete to that, with that theory. And any ideas that we apply to inflation shouldn't just be applied to inflation, they should be applied to all competitors, including this straw man theory. I'll get back to that a little bit later. So it's useful to ask, in order to get out of the predicament that we're in, it's useful to ask how we got in this predicament. It seems strange, given the amount of interest in the inflationary scenario. When it comes to the issue about inflation making no predictions, well, I want to make the point that the reason why we ended up in this predicament is essentially that we had a we made a mistake at the outset in the early days of inflation. Not a small mistake, not a question of detail, but a profound error in judgment at the beginning of our understanding of inflation, and that we didn't take proper account of how quantum mechanics and inflation really mix. Our original idea was that inflation was essentially a classical phenomenon in which quantum physics would have a small perturbative effect. But what we've learned is that's not the case at all. When you put the two together, it's a kind of toxic mix in which quantum mechanics takes over the large-scale structure of the universe, helped by inflation. So that's essentially the idea that if we have this scalar field rolling down the potential, we might think there's a certain average time to reach the end of inflation and reach the bottom of inflation, but we have to take account of the fact that there's a small fraction of the tail of the distribution in the expectation value of the scalar field, which stays behind, procrastinates. It's what I like to call a rogue region. It's badly behaved. It doesn't end inflation the way everyone else does. It doesn't end it properly. And what happens is that even though this rogue region is atypical, unusually badly behaved, when you add gravity to it, when you add inflation to it, it becomes the dominant volume of the universe. So that we made a huge error in thinking in the early days that what happens is that inflation occurs and then ends almost everywhere, and almost everywhere looks like what we observe. What we end up with is that almost nowhere looks like what we observe in the total universe. The whole geometry is turned inside out because of this amplification of these rogue regions. And only a fractal volume, this contains bubbles, contains regions which end inflation. And then because this runs forever, because this process allows inflation to run forever, quantum mechanics and its inherent uncertainties are able to run rampant and ensure that different regions aren't the same. That in fact, as Alan has eloquently put it, anything that can happen will happen, and it will happen an infinite number of times. So if we're going to say that inflation, the process of accelerated expansion, does anything, predicts anything, this is what it predicts. And I just want to point out, this is pretty much back where we started. When we had the Big Bang model, we didn't know what would come out of the Big Bang. It could have been anything. What we observed was unlikely, but not impossible. What we've ended up with, at least so far as this part of this, just stopping the story at this point, is back where we started, where everything is possible. And an infinite number of instances. I think the situation is worse still because the volume measure, the most naive measure, and other simple measures, fail to predict our universe as being likely. Inflation is all about volume. The whole motivation for inflation was to create big regions which look like what we observe. So it's really a deep disappointment, to me at least, that the volume measure fails. In fact, I may be wrong about this, but I would ask yourselves this question. Suppose the volume measure had not failed. Suppose the volume measure had predicted that universes that are flat and homogeneous and have scale invariant spectra and match the CMB were by far and away the most likely type regions that you might find. I don't think we'd be having this meeting today. So the fact that it fails, I think, is an important failure. It means that it may mean that we're destined to solve this problem by coming up with creative measures, as many have suggested, especially yesterday in the first 2 days of this meeting. But if creative measures are going to save the day, then we should appreciate the fact that the cosmology, the predictions that are going to come out of our total cosmology, are going to depend entirely on that measure principle. They're not coming from inflation. Inflation is only producing everything that's possible. Okay? It's going to come, it's going to rely heavily on, entirely, I should say, any predictions are going to rely entirely on this measure principle. And if you're going to play that game, I think you have to be fair and apply that same game to other cosmological models. That is to say, you have to apply those same rules, that same measure principle, applying it to other theories, including the straw man theory we had at the outset. So we said Big Bang without inflation was unlikely, but I should be able to play the same game and try to find an optimal measure that in that theory will also most likely predict the present universe and then do a fair comparison. And that's not being done at present. Well, that's your interpretation of measure. You'd have to count. You're counting, I mean, there's things like bubble measures. I mean, there would be infinities in this theory as well. The Big Bang would happen an infinite number of times, arbitrary number of times. So imagine the Big Bang could repeat itself many times with different initial conditions and disconnected regions. So there's an issue of how I regularize it. As for the issue of the inflation, as for the issue of inflation being highly unlikely, the reason why we didn't appreciate that at the beginning is, again, a profound error on our part, a really naive views about likely initial conditions. And I should say, when I say we did not take proper account, I'm including myself, naive views about what were likely initial conditions. Roger provided already the argument, which should have been a compelling enough argument that this is the case. He pointed out, if you think of the universe as a system with a total entropy, which is at least 10 to the 120, the typical state of the system, first of all, looks nothing like the present universe. The universe is a very rare part of phase space out of the total set of states available in the system, as measured by the fact that it has an entropy of around 10 to the 90 or 10 to the 100, compared to the total entropy available, which is at least 10 to the 120. But that inflation is an even rarer instance, a rarer possibility in this phase space, exponentially rarer, because the entropy goes like 1 upon the density. And for inflation, because the density is high, the entropy is low. So the probability of finding yourself in inflation by random chance is negligible. So in fact, there are, as one considers the situation, many ways of beginning from a typical initial state and making your way down to here, many more ways of doing that than first making your way down to a state that's extraordinarily rare and then making your way back. And that's a fundamental problem. Now, that is buttressed and enhanced by the Liouville argument that Neil presented the other day. So there, he, especially in his recent version of it that he talked about, I think the argument seems especially strong. He begins going to an asymptotic limit in which the far future is a flat space, which should obey the laws of ordinary statistical mechanics. These are essentially the same as, I think, taking Lenny's census takers. And then extrapolating backwards the cosmic histories and asking what fraction of them pass through more than 60 folds of inflation. And, of course, the answer comes back that the answer is almost none. And that's consistent with the entropy argument that Roger had posed. But I think it has, at least for my taste, a little bit more content to it. Let me stop for a moment and make a few remarks about Lenny's janitor. First of all, let me point out that I don't know Lenny's janitor, so I can't say whether he's malicious or she's malicious or not. When Lenny raised the issue, I'm going to mention this for you in case you weren't here on Tuesday, he raised the point that this Liouville argument, you know, might be suspect because there could be some special initial condition that you would never expect from the Liouville argument, but nevertheless could be true. For example, he gave the example, you come into a room and you find the, I'm giving a slight variation of it, and you find the molecules all on the, let me put it slightly differently. You have a sealed box, and you discover in that sealed box, and you look through the window that the molecules are all on the left-hand side of it, and you're asked to explain, you know, how do they manage to get that way? And one possibility is that the molecules all ended up, all started off in the corner, all made their way down to the corner, and then they're making their way out. Or the other possibility is that they were spread throughout the room, spread throughout the box, and this was a rare fluctuation in which they got down to this point. Now, if you assume a malicious, Lenny's malicious janitor is the one who came in, opened up the box, put all the molecules in the corner of the room, and then let them go, that is a logical possibility. But if you don't know the janitor, and you don't have an opportunity to talk to the janitor, and have no further information, if you're asked to infer which is the likely possibility between these two, whether they began the corner, or they began filling the box, I think probabilistically, there's no choice as to what the answer is. It can't be at the begin in the corner of the room. They have to begin filling the box. Beginning in the corner of the room is analogous to beginning in the rare state of inflation. Filling the room is beginning from a typical initial state in Roger's analysis and having a downward fluctuation. I think we have no choice but to, without some profoundly more advanced knowledge, which I don't expect that we will achieve, speaking to the janitor of the universe, I don't think we have any opportunity, any other choice, but to use the logical inference that comes from Louisville analysis. So that said, I have to say that Louisville analysis struck me when I was first coming across it, and originally in the paper of Gibbons and Turok, as somewhat counterintuitive. In particular, it seems to disfavor something which I always thought was something we wanted to achieve in a theory. It seems to disfavor strong attractor behavior. Inflation is a strong attractor. It seems if we're trying to explain the peculiar state of the universe today, having a theory which, going forward in time, attracts to it would seem to be a desirable idea. But in the Louisville analysis, what you do is you go to the far future and extrapolate backwards. And when you extrapolate backwards, what's a repeller going forwards, what's a attractor going forwards becomes a repeller going backwards. So I've come to terms with this by realizing that actually, at least in the homogeneous case, the analysis that's in Gibbons and Hawking, Gibbons and Turok, rather, actually inflation is favored. It's just that a lot of inflation isn't favored. More than 60 folds isn't favored. I'll sort of draw it symbolically this way with this little symbol over here. So this is supposed to represent the flow of time. This little blob here, I'm kind of preparing, beginning to create a set of diagrams which I can use to make a kind of flow chart. It represents, this blob here represents the epoch of inflation, and by these different paths represent different paths which go through different amounts of inflation and come out the other end with very similar conditions. And I've made it kind of skinny to emphasize the point that although there are some paths that spend a long time in the inflationary phase, most of them spend very little time in the inflationary phase. That's what I mean by a skinny attractor. What the Louisville argument is telling us is that almost all the paths spend only a few e-folds of inflation compared to many. So inflation is an attractor. Attractors are good things. But if you insist that you remain in the attractor phase in this or any other theory for a long time, that actually is a much more stringent condition. So there's no logical problem here. But it does mean that we need more than an attractor. We need to find a way of getting lots of inflation to attract. Lots of inflation to be more attractive than a little of inflation. Now, in some sense, at least for my taste, I think of the Louisville argument as being stronger than the entropy argument, at least as originally proposed by Roger. You may disagree, Roger. From Roger's point of view, at least the way I understood Roger's point of view, he was saying that if we were going to try to guess an initial condition, we should guess that it was a typical initial state. Now, someone else may come back with a different theory of possible initial conditions. Jim may come back with, you know, Hartle-Hawking. Tom may come back with, you know, holographic cosmology. Lenny might come back and say we began a landscape in a false vacuum. Okay, and so then just because at that level, it just seems to be a competition between which idea of initial conditions you consider to be more compelling. But with the Louisville argument, you don't get by so easily. Because essentially, what one's trying to do in any of those ideas is introduce some new element, which I've just called the X factor here, which is supposed to explain why you had a lot of inflation. And you're introducing it in front of, that is to say, before inflation, in such a way that it's going to force you to go through lots of inflation rather than a little inflation. And the problem with that is that the Louisville argument, when you run backwards, it doesn't help you at all, because for the same reason you miss going through a lot of inflation, you miss this X factor. So if you're going to try to use the Louisville argument to help measure the relative probability of different theories for how the universe began, it doesn't help you to put something in front of inflation. It's too late. Going backwards, you've already reached the repeller. You're already repelled from this state. It's telling you that your theory is unlikely. So you're back to the malicious janitor problem idea again. You think you know the janitor, and he's malicious. Another interesting corollary of the Louisville argument is the way things fail. So given a scalar field rolling down a potential, how does it fail when you run backwards? You begin with a field which is oscillating around the potential or undergoing some sort of ellipse in phase space, and you extrapolate backwards in time. What you find is, beginning from a typical such oscillatory state, what happens is the kinetic energy rises much faster than the potential energy, so that you don't spend a lot of time on the inflationary plateau that you made such an effort to design into your theory. You miss it almost entirely because the kinetic energy is too large compared to the potential energy to inflate. Now, in thinking about it, that's kind of an obvious statement. Kinetic energy and potential energy scale at different rates as a function of scale factor. So when I extrapolate backwards, it's not surprising that typically one rises faster than another. In fact, except for special cases like oscillations, they're going to cross at one and only one time. And there's no particular reason why that should be true as the initial condition. That's a rather special condition. In fact, the opposite is the case. What the Louisville argument is suggesting is that because this kinetic energy tends to scale much faster than the potential energy, you're likely to have this initial condition where the kinetic energy is much larger than the potential energy. And that's, in fact, why, then, going forward, you tend to run past the plateau without not having much inflation. So if you're going to posit an initial condition, it ought to be that the kinetic energy is exponentially much larger, much exponentially more likely initial condition than the potential energy. I just want to point out that that is in contrast with what was the standard law, or has been the standard law for a long time, as expressed, for example, in Linde's recent tome on inflation, in which he says that the most natural initial conditions at the moment when the classical description of the universe first becomes feasible are, and here they are, a kind of equipartition idea, an idea that the kinetic and potential, for example, should be similar. The Louisville argument is telling us that that is not logical, extrapolating backwards in time. In fact, it not only tells us it's unlikely, it tells us how much more likely it is for kinetic energy to be much larger than the potential energy. The answer is exponentially so. It's very unlikely for them to be comparable. And that, again, is why inflation ends up being disfavored. Okay, so how might we fix these problems? Well, one approach, or some of the approaches we've heard about in the last few days to try to fix it within the context of inflation, but if I'm just going to try to work my way backwards and try to begin again without that bias, without that prejudice, I would say the first thing you want to do is make sure that you smooth the universe in a way that does not reward the rogue regions. In fact, you want to smooth and flatten the universe while, if anything, penalizing the rogue regions. And how might you do that? Well, you can smooth and flatten while penalizing the rogue regions if, during the smoothing phase, the expansion rate is much slower than it is after smoothing is done, and even after it's even smaller than it is today. Because then any rogue regions left behind in the smoothing phase, due to random quantum fluctuations that don't end on time, all that happens to them is that they end up expanding much more slowly than regions that behave properly. And so instead of gaining volume, they lose volume relative to the well-behaved regions, and so you don't have this eternal runaway, eternal smoothing process taking over. You don't give quantum mechanics the chance to do its thing and produce large volumes of space with every conceivable possibility. Now, you actually saw this expression yesterday in Jean-Luc's talk, in which he began from a specific theory of colliding brains and cyclic universes, and pointed out that there was this property and why it was beneficial. Here I'm coming to the same point, but I'm sort of doing this, kind of the same point, but the reasoning is kind of this reverse engineering. How are we going to avoid producing these rogue regions? Now it's a question of how you construct theories with this property. Now, one of the challenges you're going to have in constructing such a theory is that, as long as you're doing them in the context of general relativity, you're going to have some region where the Hubble parameter grows from the small value it has in the smoothing phase to the large value it has to have afterwards. And in according to the Friedman equation, what that's going to require is some kind of violation of the null energy condition, which is going to make Ben very, very unhappy. Or it's going to require some sort of bounce, some sort of singular bounce, or some sort of deviation from classical general relativity. There are two logical possibilities. So we're going to have to deal with that. This is going to be a central issue on whether this line of reasoning is going to work or not. For the moment, let me put it off. There are two logical possibilities here. One is H could be positive in the smoothing phase. That means you're smoothing while you're expanding. And I think Roger's going to give a version which something like that happens. Or the other thing is that you can do the smoothing while contracting. So you'd be contracting, and then you're going to need some kind of bounce, some sort of big crunch, big bang transition, which has the property that preserves the information, the smoothness and flatness and the other conditions you created going in on the way out. Now, before, let me point out that contraction has some immediate advantages that I think are worth your attention. The first is, the moment we introduce this idea of a bounce in which there's information that could exist before the Big Bang and travel past the Big Bang, time is no longer limited by the Big Bang. Time exists before. So the causality problem, which plagues the original Big Bang model, and which was one of the arguments for inflation, isn't here in this case, because there's plenty of time before the bang in which for these regions to get in causal contact. Secondly, although it's often said that inflation is the only solution to the flatness problem, contraction automatically solves the flatness problem just by having a long period of contraction. You can see that logically just because the flatness problem has to do with the fact that if you have a slowly expanding universe, the contribution of the curvature term to the Friedman equation grows with time. Just run that film backwards and you have a contracting universe, and that means the flatness term becomes less important going back in time. So flatness is not a problem in a contracting universe. All you need to make sure is that the amount of flattening that occurred during the contraction phase exceeds the amount of unflattening that's occurred since, and you've solved the flatness problem. Analogous to inflation, except we're not using inflation. We're using actually the opposite, contraction. Now, that's not enough to do the whole job, as has been pointed out by Jean-Luc and Justin this morning. Because as the universe contracts, all the contributions, the matter density, radiation density, anisotropy, curvature grow, but they grow at different rates. And the term that's most worrisome is a term which grows at the fastest rate, which, at least in the terms I've written down so far, is this anisotropy term. So you, instead of having a flatness problem in a contracting universe, what you actually have is an anisotropy problem. And you can defeat this in a way analogous to what you do in inflation, which is you introduce, in case of inflation, you introduce something that beats curvature. Here we're going to introduce something that beats during contraction, beats anisotropy. That is to introduce, say, a scalar field or some form of stress energy whose equation of state is greater than 1, then it scales at a rate 1 upon A to the 3, 1 plus W, where 3, 1 plus W is greater than 6. So this becomes the dominant contribution. These contributions all become subdominant, and all the energy density and evolution of the universe, once this component takes over, it's this component that controls the future evolution of the universe, analogous to what the inflaton does in an expanding universe. Now, this W has to be larger than 1. Getting such a field component with this property is not difficult. A scalar field rolling down a negative potential, if you just write down the equation of state for a scalar field rolling down a negative potential with an ordinary canonical kinetic energy automatically has this property. In fact, you can get quite large Ws in such a theory, which means that this term grows even more rapidly compared to anisotropy and curvature and all that than, say, the inflaton does compared to them. So, I mean, it's not only an effective mechanism, it's a super effective mechanism when you get to large W of smoothing and flattening the universe. It's in some sense, for the same change in scale factor, it can be more effective, more smoothing and flattening. We don't need more. I mean, but the point is it's a very powerful attractor. Now, so our goal was to smooth and flatten while penalizing rogue regions. The issue with inflation is that the smoothing and flattening occurs while the field is high in the potential. The energy density is large, and the Hubble constant is large compared to where we sit today, or where we can sit after inflation is over, which is down here. In the kinds of models that we're being driven to in the contracting case, we need a contracting field. We need a field which is introducing a period of contraction, a negative potential. In this case, the contraction occurs when the energy density is extremely small and regions are contracting. Whereas after the contraction phase is over, the field bounces. We come back to an expanding phase full of hot matter and radiation. So regions which are well-behaved are expanding. Regions which are poorly behaved, these rogue regions, are contracting. They simply don't compete for volume. They simply disappear. They get eaten up by the regions which manage to make it through. In the cyclic version of the model, as was pointed out by Jean-Luc, the field runs off to infinity, comes back, and ends up on a plateau with a very small positive energy density and large radiation density. Again, the Hubble constant decreases steadily as the universe expands until this vacuum density or plateau density begins to dominate. We would be near that phase today. We'd be near the beginning of that phase today. But the entire history of the universe up to that point is one of a larger H, one which is expanding much faster than it will be than here. So if there are rogue regions not left behind here, but left behind here in the previous cycle, they still have not grown as much in volume as regions which were well-behaved. Furthermore, when they finally finish their rogue job, they'll end up tending towards this ekparotic phase, and where they'll be smoothed and flattened out anyway, they will just sort of be delayed compared to regions which were well-behaved. So it looks to me like this avoids this problem of rogue regions. There are other possible advantages of this kind of theory compared to the standard inflationary model. The entropy density the entropy associated with the inflationary phase, we pointed out, is extremely small, owing to the fact that it has a very large energy density. The kind of potentials one wants for these kinds of models are ones, let's say, in the cyclic case, in which the energy density is extremely small. In fact, 100 orders of magnitude smaller. So if you're comparing these two models, if you're going to ask how they compete, it's interesting that this has higher entropy. And so, for example, if you had a landscape which had both these and these would be more probable by that argument. I'd be an interesting question for Jim whether or not if he were to conclude a landscape that included both of these possibilities, whether he'd find this or this is favored. Now, he would then apply, pardon, yeah? Yeah, I believe you're going to find that this is because of the entropy, I believe because your probability of production is dependent, is basically e to the s, you're going to find that this is exponentially favored. Now, you would follow up and say, yeah, but you get all this additional help from volume factors over here. But the thing is, you get those same volume factors over here if this ends up being a cyclic model. So, if this ends up cycling. So this is an interesting point. Another interesting advantage from these contracting models is the fact that you have more time may allow you to solve other cosmological problems. For example, you might get, instead of an anthropic explanation for the cosmological constant, you might find ways of making dynamical explanations for the cosmological constant. For example, suppose the cosmological constant is not a constant, but is slowly relaxing with time. In particular, I want to imagine one which relaxes on a time scale which is extremely long compared to 14 billion years, completely long to what we'd normally think would be the lifetime of the universe, in the Big Bang model, the lifetime of the universe. It wouldn't make sense to talk about such a thing in the standard Big Bang or Big Bang inflationary theory, but it makes perfect sense to talk about it in a model which, you know, which there's something, something before the bang. And by allowing yourself that larger time scale, it would mean that, for example, over the course of 14 billion years, it would appear to be a cosmological constant, as if it were constant. But in fact, if you go back in time, you would have found, going back in time, it was progressively larger, let's say, beginning initially, where you might have expected near the Planck's density, and slowly relaxing. Now, if the universe is undergoing many cycles during this period, then during each cycle, as Jean-Luc pointed out yesterday, the volume of the universe grows. So the universe, there's more and more volume as you get to later and later times in such a relaxation model, when the cosmological constant is getting smaller and smaller. And this continues to such point that the cosmological constant becomes negative. When it becomes negative, it's, well, what's happening in this model is it's like taking this potential and progressively moving it downwards and finally moving it down to a point where this plateau is negative. And that point, things end. Things come to collapse. So that's sort of a terminal state for the system. So there would be a minimal value. So what this model tends to do is favor small cosmological constant, because most of the time and volume of the universe is spent when this cosmological constant is small rather than large. So that's a possible kind of dynamical explanation for the cosmological constant, which I think is conceptually appealing to at least me. Okay, so there could be a lower bound. Also, so the question is, could there be, is there a lower bound that you could have that would not permit it to be, that would not permit it to get closer to zero? And the answer is, in some context, yes. So, for example, Jean-Luc gave, described yesterday this Phoenix model, in which, in that model, only a small fraction of the universe which hits the bounce manages to get through and expand. And you need a condition, which is that the total amount of expansion that you get from during the expanding phase compensates for the amount of volume you lost on the way in. In order to do that, you need to rely on having a dark energy phase. That's actually a reason why you would need dark energy, and you'd need it to last a certain amount of time, 60 EFOLs in the example that we've worked out. Okay, and so that means the cosmological constant can't be arbitrarily small. It would have to have some minimal value. So that provides a lower cutoff to the theory. And although I'm not prepared to argue the case, I think the logical conclusion is that we're near that lower bound. And if you were to, you know, if you ask where you spend most of your time in evolution, it would be as close to that, relatively close to that lower bound. So that would give you a prediction most directly on the number of EFOLs of inflation, but within the context of the model, the value of the cosmological constant. I think I'll skip the last remark. Of course, a key idea here, which needs to be addressed, which is still the key open idea, is that one needs to have a bounce, which is going to be, for this purpose, is unitary, analytic, smooth, well-behaved. If it has those properties, it's essentially a unique way to match conditions from before to after. When we say these models make predictions, what we're assuming is that there exists a bounce with this property. That's still an unproven proposition. But I think introducing a bounce into cosmology has some interesting benefits beyond it, besides enabling these models to exist. First of all, I want to point out that the bounce may or may not be generic. It may be that typically regions do bounce if they've undergone an ekpyrotic phase, but it could also, in such a model, or it may be that under only special conditions they do, if they've been smoothed and flattened to a high degree. The non-generic possibility is an interesting idea. It's kind of like a sieve. It means that if one considers all the possible states which are entering, which reach the bounce phase, which I represent as all these different cosmic histories coming in from the right, that unless they undergo a sufficient amount of smoothing and flattening before they reach the bounce, they'll have a high amount of curvature and warp and will end up collapsing into black holes the way you might conventionally expect as you approach a big crunch. but only regions which are smoothed and flattened sufficiently will manage to make their way through. This environment, this means that the bounce could act like a kind of sieve. For sieving out regions with large geometrical entropy, they would form black holes that essentially, in terms for all practical purposes, those cosmic histories would come to an end. Only passing through regions with tiny geometrical entropy. And if you look back at Roger's argument, the issue there is that most of the states with high entropy are states with large geometrical entropy. Actually, after the big,
what we want to get to is states with low geometrical entropy but high matter entropy, hot matter and radiation. And this is what would naturally pass through this sieve, we would propose. Now, of course, I should mention that this state reminds me a lot of what Tom and Willie are talking about, in that it would be basically a soup of black holes with W near equals 1, but with holes in it coming from regions which had been sufficiently flattened. So I don't know if that connects to your ideas, but it'd be interesting to have a discussion about that and see if those two ideas could be united rather than an inflating phase. As Charles pointed, this represents a kind of non-Hamiltonian evolution. So when we apply the Liouville theorem, we are assuming Hamiltonian evolution in that analysis. So we have to be careful in dealing with this phase, if it acts in this sieve-like way. And again, I think that's an open issue that needs to be considered. I'll come back to that a little bit in my last remark. Now, if this backwards line of reasoning, which is, I've come to a model that I was thinking about for other reasons, but if this backward line of reasoning is correct, that we want to get to small h, we want to get to large w, there are immediate observational consequences. The fact that h is small during the smoothing phase means that the amplitude of gravitational waves are going to be small, exponentially small compared to what you'd expect to get in inflation, e to the 50th, 10 to the 50th times smaller. The fact that h is not constant, but h is increasing as you head towards the bounce, means that the spectrum of gravitational waves, which is proportional to h squared, is not going to be scale invariant. It's going to be blue because h is increasing in magnitude. Because w is large, it means that whether it's a scalar field or some other form of stress energy which is causing this phase, it's going to have strong self-interactions. It's not going to be anything like a free scalar field. It's not going to be produce Gaussian fluctuations. So in particular, it will generally produce large, significant deviations from Gaussianity. I think that's a generic statement. Jean-Luc presented particular results for the case of the cyclic model and in the case that you had this conversion from during the kinetic phase. This kind of analysis is model dependent, is highly model dependent. But I think the general statement I would make is that inflation, at least with a single scalar field, if one doesn't do anything to produce large deviations, if one doesn't do anything to muck it up, produces values of F and L which are going to be less than 1, close to Gaussian because the field is nearly free. Whereas here, you're going to be in the opposite limit. You're typically going to get F and L's of order 10s or bigger. And that's interesting because experimentally we're close to testing both of these claims. And of course, if we see gravitational waves, that means this whole line of reasoning can be thrown away. If we don't see significant Gaussianity beyond F and L of 1, we can throw this whole line of reasoning away. On the other hand, it's possible we will see no gravitational waves and significant non-Gaussianity. And I think that would be important corroborative evidence of this line of reasoning. Given what I hope, given the advantages that I've described. Okay, finally, I want to revisit the Liouville argument, because I didn't discuss that yet, and discuss the way a way in which, in a sense, this model succeeds by the Liouville measure. So we're going to imagine what I've done this time is I've amended the potential we had before by putting a small dip in it, so that this dip comes down to 0. So we can imagine preparing the universe as an initial state where the field is just sitting here with small fluctuations around that minimum, but in a contracting phase. So in such a space-time, the universe is nearly flat. So one has a condition where one has legitimate sensance takers. One can use conventional statistical mechanics to begin to measure the probability of different cosmic histories, labeling them according to their entropy, and then studying the set of cosmic histories with fixed entropy and ask where they go. I should say, this is an artificial model by providing this, whether this is literally the initial state or some state that you get to really isn't important in this analysis. What's important is there's some stage in this analysis, some stage in this cosmic history where we have nearly flat space observers in which conventional statistical mechanics can be used to judge, to judge where we go forward or where we have legitimate census takers. So what's going to happen in this model is as the universe contracts, as the field, its oscillations are going to increase. They're going to increase because the universe is contracting, the kinetic energies are being blue-shifted. And finally, they'll increase to the point where the field spills over the edge, and when it spills over the edge, it'll come down the potential. So contraction amplifies the oscillations until the field spills over the edge across the barrier, and then it will come down and roll the rest of the way. So almost all initial conditions, beginning at the bottom here, will happen. They'll just barely make it over the edge, and they'll all experience the entire way down. So almost all initial conditions lead to nearly full ekparotic phase, which is n much greater than 60 e-folds of smoothing. In fact, like 120 e-folds of smoothing. So this is also an attractor phase. Pardon, I assumed what? Yes, I choose as my initial. Yes, yeah. Sorry, I didn't hear the. Yeah, so I want to provide a set of census takers and ask what happens to them. Yeah. Yeah. So we want to say, imagine cosmology in which we're asymptotically flat in the past, which would be this condition, and then ask, and it's contract, but then it starts contracting, as opposed to where in the other limit, we assume it's asymptotically expanding in the future, and it's flat. So I think you're allowed, in terms of constructing the argument, you're allowed to consider either possibility. So we have a bunch, so in other words, so remember, we're not allowed in the other argument to consider observers who don't reach this flat condition. We only consider observers who begin asymptotically flat in the future, and we extrapolate backwards. Here we're beginning only with observers who are seeing asymptotically flat in the past and extrapolating forwards. Because the flat space observers happen to be in the past, not in the future. So we're beginning with the census takers that exist in the model. This is where they live. Pardon? This could be the janitors or something like that. So the point is that almost all the initial conditions experience much more than 60 folds of inflation. So in terms of my little diagram over here, this is what I call a fat attractor, which means to say almost all paths spend a lot of time in the smoothing phase. So by this, and then we bounce, and then we come, and then we bounce. And what we conclude from this is that the most likely number of e-folds of ekparotic smoothing you get in such a model is going to be of order 120, as opposed to the case of inflation, where we concluded that the likely amount of e-folds of inflation you were going to get was going to be of order 1. So the Louisville analysis in this case goes forwards. You extrapolate forwards from the, in this case, we have to extrapolate forwards from the census takers. Our census takers in the past, we extrapolate forward rather than backwards. Now, one can consider one other variant of this model in which we make census takers both in the past and the future. So this time I can again begin in this initial state with a set of census takers, ask what happens to them, discover going forwards in time that they're going to spill over the top and come down to the bottom. But in this case, if Ben will permit me for a moment, I will violate the null energy condition and introduce a non-singular bounce, at least for the purposes of trying to ask this hypothetical question about the Louisville analysis. In this case, we come over the edge, and then we end up over here, and we eventually, now in an expanding phase, and we settle at the bottom over here. So again, there are other census takers. Now there are census takers both in our past and our future, these cosmologies. Okay. So this end, in terms of this cosmology, what's happened is we've introduced this fat attractor phase, we've introduced this bounce, and this bounce is going to be selective. It's going to be a sieve. Some phases won't make it to the bounce. They'll fall short and form black holes, or shoot over the top and form other regions where they never reach this flat phase. We're only interested in the Louisville analysis and asking the far, far future about those regions which, those census takers which reach the flat phase and extrapolating backwards. And you can ask the question, and now you can impose the condition, consider the set of states that have both, are both flat in the past and flat in the future. And if you ask about that subset of states, that set of states, you'll find that they also experience almost entirely all the EFOLs of smoothing. So it seems that whether one thinks backwards or forwards in this particular model, one ends up with the same conclusion that going through a long period of ekphorosis seems likely. There's a caveat here, which is one has to figure out how to deal in this Louisville analysis with this sieve, this non-Hamiltonian process, which is this blocking of certain paths, which blocks certain paths going forward and going backwards. And so I'd say I'm less certain about this argument about the extrapolating backwards at present. It's something that Neil and I are thinking about and trying to improve upon. So I just want to conclude by saying that, or summarize what I've tried to express today as simply this, that inflationary model might be wrong. It's not too big to fail. You should at least consider the possibility, given its present problems. You should try to learn from those problems and see if you can find a better model. And I think that is a line of inquiry which I hope many of you will try. Thank you.
Okay, I think, well...